too. Switch into Old Irish, I bind my sheep to a red kite, as I turn my back and throw off my robe. They see it fall, and may shrink down to a bird of prey at the same time. I screech at them, and all of them gasp. But the new pack members, especially. They've all endured the painful transformation to a werewolf, and can't conceive of the process being fast and smooth. I take wing and circle around them a couple of times, their eyes following me, and I can see the kids are excited now. I light next to me robe and shape-shift directly to a bear, giving them a friendly grunt. They're delighted by it. And this is Greta's cue to come on over and drape the robe across me back. I turn around and shift back to human, and the robe falls into place. All her idea.
Nobody's going to mind a little ass,
she said to me before they arrived.
But it's hardly necessary to show them the whole package, is it?
I didn't see why it mattered, but she did, so I agreed to do it her way. The kids are so juiced they can't stand still. A couple of them actually jump up and down and clap. And the parents are happy too, smiling down at their kids, because such joy is infectious. Gaia gives druids these farms to help protect her better. Our primary function is to protect the earth. And she'll do that by watching out for the elementals. And in turn, they kind of watch out for you. When you're bound to the earth, you'll be able to talk to the elementals directly. But I can let you talk to the elemental here, right now. Flagstaff rests on the Colorado Plateau, so we think of this elemental as Colorado. I've already let it know you'll be here today, and it's going to give each of you a small sphere of sandstone, which I don't want you to lose. You'll use it to talk to Colorado. First, take off your shoes so the earth can feel your presence. I have never seen any group of kids so eager to be barefoot. They all plop down and start tugging at their shoes, and their parents laugh. Once they're all back on their feet and wriggling their toes in the earth, I send a message to Colorado through my tattoos that the new apprentices are ready and standing opposite me. The ground in front of the kids breaks and crumbles, and spheres of sandstone rise up out of it, each with a slightly different pattern of tans and reds. All right, I want you to pick up the stone, close it in your hand, and concentrate on saying hello to the earth. It doesn't matter what language you use, it won't use language to reply back. But you'll feel it. They all bend down to pick up their stones and then scrunch their eyes closed in concentration. I have to admit, it's feckin' adorable. After about 10 seconds, they start laughing and happy crying when they hear Colorado in their heads. And damn, if me own eyes don't get watery at the edges. It's tough to not get emotional when you finally realize that you're not trapped on the planet with things that want to eat you or tell you what to do. All the Earth wants you to do is thrive. And you feel that love whenever you contact an elemental. I look up at the parents and tell them we'll be at it a while and they can let us be. You can ask me any other questions you might have later on. They say thank you by word or gesture and depart with Greta and Sam, leaving me with the kids and the three translators. I let the kids commune until the parents are out of sight, and then I interrupt them. Colorado doesn't speak in language, you may have noticed. You get pictures and feelings. You can ask it simple questions, though, and it'll understand what you mean, as long as you think it really hard. Ask Colorado to show you the places and creatures it loves the most. You'll see. Some of them whisper the question aloud in their effort to think really hard. But once Colorado begins to answer, their faces switch from awe to surprise, to wide smiles and more, as images filter through their heads. Whatever they're seeing, it's all new to them, since they come from very different parts of the world, and would not be familiar with the native plants and animals here. I give them a few minutes, and then thank Colorado, asking it to stop. All right! I want you to tell me what you saw, do ya? You go first. One by one, down the line, they tell me about snakes and lizards and scorpions, mule deer and native trout, the blue-green waters of Havasupai Falls in the Grand Canyon, the sandstone buttes of the Navajo Nation, and the canyons cut by floodwaters there. Tandy's last, and she begins to tell me about coyotes, but then breaks off, and her eyes pull away from me face to look at something over me right shoulder. She points and squeaks, "Big ugly man!" I half expect it to be a joke, and get a round of giggles out of them when I turn around to look. But she isn't kidding. The very definition of big and ugly is coming this way out of the pine trees. It's that feckin' bog troll who says I owe him gold.
Holy shit.
One of the translators mutters. All of ye, run back to the house now, I says. Find Greta and your parents and tell him there's a troll come calling. Shoo, now, go on. The translators herd them away and the kids scurry toward the house with jerky little kid legs, leaving their shoes behind. It's a grim face I'm wearing when I go to meet the troll. He's lumbering in long, plodding steps, and he still hasn't figured out how to hide his dangly bits. What he has figured out is how to find me and get here without using one of the old ways, a feat I thought impossible. And it probably still is. What's really happened is that he's found someone to help him, and the bastard has also ripped up a young aspen tree to pound me with. Well, we'll see who does the pounding. I fish me knuckles out of the robe pocket, slip them on, and charge them up as I walk. And I also mutter the bindings to increase me strength and speed. I like to simply go at him, but I need to know first how he got here. There are bound trays nearby, Jehan saw to that, which means one of the Tuatha De Danann could have brought him. It certainly wasn't Granuaile or Jehan. It could not have been any of the lesser fae, because most of them need oak, ash, and thorn to shift, especially if they're bringing someone else with them. And there isn't any of that growing together in this part of the country. That leaves two possibilities. He came to Earth via one of the old ways in Europe, and travelled here under a glamour. Extremely unlikely. Or there's an old way up in the San Francisco peaks we don't know about. I thought there weren't any old ways on this side of the globe, but it's possible that someone made a new one. A shiver of dread tickles me spine at a thought, and I say to the troll, all smiles, "Morning, lad, good morning! How was Fand when ye spoke to her?"
"She's fine," he says without thinking, because trolls are grand at that.
"Good to hear that is. She's very helpful, eh? Helping you find me and then arranging a path for you to get here. So kind."
"She's good, yes."
"And all that from prison?" "A prison, I might add, chosen by myself and her mother, Fliddish. I had acted as Breit's proxy in that matter, to make sure Fand would be secure, and Fliddish had come along to make sure her daughter was well treated, and the Fae would have no cause to complain on that score."
"She's truly powerful."
The bog troll's gnarled grey face squishes and moves around with great effort of thinking.
Prison? She's not in prison?
That tickle of dread becomes the uncomfortable sound of me bowels liquefying. For he had just confirmed me worst fear. At some point, Fand had quietly escaped, and was now helping bog trolls hunt down druids, in addition to whatever other shenanigans she could think of. Since starting a war in Tir na n'Og was her last great idea, I don't like to think of what else she might be up to now. Oh, I says, chuckling at him. That's right, I forgot she's out. Where is she now?
She's at... Wait.
The horrible accident of his face turned suspicious.
I'm not supposed to say.
Damn. So close. At least I'd learned more than Fand would have liked.
I'm here for my gold,
he rumbles.
Ye crossed my bridge and never paid. It's time.
He twitches the tree trunk at me in a not-so-subtle threat. Greta will never get me to buy a cell phone, but she did show me the internet and get me signed up on this thing called Twitter under the name of @ArcDruidOwen, so I could learn how people today can socialize while being separated by hundreds or thousands of miles. And she told me about internet trolls, which are smaller and less dangerous than bog trolls, but may smell just as bad. I remember her first rule regarding them, which was actually my own rule 2,000 years ago, and smile up at my uninvited guest. Sorry, lad, but I never feed the trolls. And then I haul off and punch him hard. Directly in the dong. Troll skin is naturally tough, and makes wearing armor unnecessary. And troll skin foreskin is no different. But me new brass knuckles could shatter rock. So I wasn't quite sure what would happen when I make contact. In hindsight, I should have pulled me punch a bit. But I'm so mad that he's there, threatening me new grove, and that Fand's escaped, that I just go for it. Which means I'm abruptly in a new kind of nightmare, when me fist punctures the skin and keeps going. I'm up to me elbow in spongy troll cock. And we're both profoundly unhappy about it, and yelling fit to be the banshee. He crumples inward by reflex, grabs with his massive left hand and yanks me out of there and tosses me through the air a good 30 yards or so. I land on the exposed face of a half-buried boulder, and it crunches me left shoulder blade, shooting pain through the whole arm before it goes numb and useless. I roll onto me right side in the bunch grass and lever me body up, staggering to me feet as the troll realizes he's not going to die, but just be permanently disfigured in his dank and smelly junk. He gets powerful angry about it, and forgets all about getting his gold out of me. All he wants now is to stomp me to a smear in the mud, or bash me on the head with that tray of his. He picks the latter option. Bellowing and charging with the tree, though due to his injury, he's kind of lurching more than running. The day I passively wait for a charge to arrive is the day you can dip me in a lake of salted whale shite. Speaking quickly, I throw off my robe and shapeshift to a ram. I charge him right back, lame left front leg and all. I'm still faster than he is by a far stretch. He's a right-handed lad, so he'll be planting his left foot to take his swing.
That's the leg I aim for, as I lower me head, horns covered in the brass. He tries to adjust and take me out with his aspen trunk, but whiffs over me head as I get inside his guard. I plow into his left shin, and don't completely take off his leg, but it's an air thing. The bones audibly fracture in a few places, and I stumble sideways, rocked by the collision. He goes down loud and heavy, and won't be charging me again. The bones have erupted through the back of his leg and stick up like spires. Thing is that there's no easy way to finish him off, and I will be finishing him off out of necessity. You can't put your fist through a man's wood and expect him to forgive and forget. He had gone too far in coming after me, and I had gone too far in my response. It's a death match now, and it's not going to be easy for either of us to survive. Climb up on his back and he can roll over and crush me. Try to get to any of his organs and his perfectly functioning arms and hands can get to me first. He's already looking for me, and damn it, while I'm looking at his face, he kicks out blindly with his right foot, a trick move where he's bending it over his left while lying face down, and it knocks me over, and I land on that lame left shoulder. Bone grinds against bone, and I bleat, which is a feckin' awful noise. The ram form isn't useful anymore. So I shapeshift to a bear as he rolls over to his back, pivots on his hips, and raises that log of a leg in an attempt to heel kick me into paste. My left arm still isn't working, of course, but I'm counting on the right one to win this. I dart in a bit closer, raise up on my back feet, and meet that troll's leg with me claws, gouging deep grooves across the tendons at the back of his ankle, and, effectively, halting his descent. After the reflexive recoil, he brings it down again. Pain be damned, and I'm still there. I'm clubbed to the ground by the back of his calf, and see spots in me vision. But I just keep lashing out with me claws, until the pressure disappears, and is rolled away to escape me. I struggle up, and am unsteady on me paws. Forget I'm injured, and try to put weight on me left front foot, which crashes me to the ground again. When I manage to lift myself off the ground once more, I see through blurred vision that the troll is grabbing for that tree trunk with giant fingers. He's also spinning around somehow in the sky. But I know that can't be really happening. He's clocked me upside the head right well. Might as well be dead already, because I don't have the wits left to dodge another blow, even if I can accurately judge where it's coming from in time. Three of those trees rise up in the air and hang there for an impossible time, frozen like I was on that island for all those years. And then they begin to fall in different directions. I hear them, or it, crash back to earth, but I'm not rightly sure where it lands, except that it's not on top of me. My vision won't focus, and I blink furiously trying to locate the troll, and when I finally find him, he's not moving. He's underneath the tree, and I think that's mighty strange. Then I see the stained grass and earth around us, and realize that he bled to death. My claws must have opened a few arteries, and combined with his broken leg and that other thing I did, he ran out of juice pretty fast. I shapeshift back to human, and lie on my right side so all my tattoos can soak up energy and help me heal. Moving that much makes everything spin again, and I'm sick on the grass. Greta's face appears in front of mine soon after that, and all I can think is that I probably still have vomit in me beard.
Owen! Owen! The kids said this thing is a troll!
Are they safe?
The kids? Yes. You don't look so good. Your arm's out of its socket.
It is? Well, it's worse than that on the inside.
Owen, your eyes aren't tracking me. Can you see me?
Oi? All four? No! Five of you.
You're concussed.
That's a new word for me, and I tell her so. I don't know what that means. Hope it means I'm handsome.
Of course you are. But tell me, are you healing right now?
Aye. Trying to.
Focus your efforts on your brain. It's probably swelling. And don't go to sleep.
Aye, you should say that because... I'm quite sleepy.
No, no, don't sleep. Talk to me. Why is there a troll here?
I owed him money. You didn't want Canadian money, though. Showed him the Queen and the King of Canada and everything, but he wouldn't take it.
What? You're not making sense.
It's because a friend. She escaped. She's free. We have to find her.
Which one is Fand again?
The one who wants to kill us all, because we aren't living in the past.
Is this because of something your apprentice did?
Our expression darkens just referring to him like that. And I think sometimes she would blame Sheehan for bad weather, if she could. No, love, not this time. This time it's my own fault. My fault? I never fed the trolls. My fault that Fand escaped and sent him here. I'm sorry.
How is it your fault that Fand escaped?
I was responsible for keeping her locked up. However she managed to spring free, I should have thought of it first.
I hate that shoulda, woulda, coulda crap, Owen. You can never go back. You can only go forward. Like this arm here. You can't go back to when it was never dislocated. You can only shove it back in and hope it heals all right. I'm gonna do that now.
She says, grabbing me near the elbow. Easy now. I'm handsome and concussed. Maybe she tries to go easy, and maybe she doesn't. It feckin' hurts regardless, and I howl about it when it pops back in. She doesn't apologize, though, because there's simply no help for some pain. Sometimes you just have to clench your teeth and endure it.
What are we going to do about this body?
She says.
We can't leave it here.
I'll have the earth take it in, I answer. The kids don't need to see it all torn up like that. And they don't need to see me like this either. You'll keep them away until I'm healed, won't you, love?
Yes, I will. Or their parents will. They're all at the house now. Except for Mohammed, I guess. Because here he comes.
Mohammed's a lad of Greta's mind about the past. He doesn't ask what happened, but rather asks what needs to be done next. Greta requests a new set of clothes for me and some water, and I dash his way to fetch them. But in doing so, moving forward in Greta's mind, he's still dealing with the past. It's always strung out behind us, isn't it? Attached to our arses like a roll of toilet paper we trail out of the bathroom, pointing the way to the giant shite we just took. It doesn't matter if we flushed it down. Everyone still knows what we did there. So it's fine to say it's all done and you have no connection with the past, that you're a new person every second, but silly, in my view, to pretend that person isn't made of the old one. I know I can't feed myself that plate of bollocks and swallow it. I can go forward and maybe put Fan back in prison before she does any more harm, but I can't pretend I'm not at least partially responsible for her escaping in the first place. And I can't pretend that I don't understand Sheehan anymore. The lad's got himself mired in a bog far worse than the one this troll used to live in, and he doesn't know how, or even if, he's going to get out of it. I have to tell Bria that her enemy is loose. And I don't know how I'll manage that without dying of shame. But it's nothing compared to what me old apprentice is facing. Times were a whole lot simpler. Back when they were frozen for me.
Chapter 12.
Fand had recently set the Dark Elves after me as part of her effort to rid the Fae of one Iron Druid, and I barely escaped my encounters with them. Had they not relied on their magical weapons, against which my cold iron aura proved to be excellent armor, they would have ended me for sure. They were strong and fast, and unlike the average Bond villain, not given to conversation. Rather, they were silent and implacable, like the nameless thing you used to fear was hiding in your closet or under your bed. Childhood nightmares made of flesh and smoke. I had never been to Svartalfheim, but knew in theory where it was. Mananon MacLear had given me a map of the Nine Realms, which placed the entrance in Nivelheim between the Ver and Ilger rivers. It wasn't a scale, however, and I doubted very much that the entrance would be as plainly visible as it was on the map. And since we would have no luck putting Svartalfheim into a GPS app, I was somewhat worried that we might spend significant time just figuring out how to get there. Briett was waiting for me at her throne in the Fae Court when I arrived, already dressed for battle and leaning on the sort of massive oversized sword one saw in anime. Unlike the diminutive protagonists of those dramas, she had the muscle to swing such a massive weapon. She also had a set of armor and a shield ready for me. Govnew's old kit, in fact, which fit me well and assured me instantly of its quality. She helped me into it, since none of her Fae attendants could get close to me without turning to ash. As she did so, I noticed that there appeared to be fresh etchings in the armor, laid down on top of the old decorative patterns. Some of the edges were still raw. "Is this a binding of some kind?" I asked.
"Added it last night," Briett said. "Protection against fire. I know your aura protects you from my fire to some extent, but that won't protect the armor itself or your sword. Pointless to have your skin immune and not what you're wearing. You'll cook in this otherwise."
"Not sure I understand," I said. "Are you planning to set me on fire?"
"How do you think we're getting to Svartalfheim?" Briett replied. "We're flying there, aflame. We have to follow the roots of Yggdrasil down to Nivelheim, and then cross a considerable distance to get to the dark doors of Svartalfheim."
I tried my best not to geek out. I had always wanted to fly like a mutant superhero, and flying with Briett was bound to be a smoother ride than the jerky, twitching ascent to Asgard that Pyrrhun gave me one time. I covered my excitement by saying, "You know how to get there already?"
"I scouted it soon after Owen told me the Morrigan's message. The entrance is guarded."
She wrapped the scabbard and handle of Frograw in a ribbon marked with the same bindings as the armor, and then we were ready. We shifted separately to the same point on Earth, or Midgard, where one of the main routes of Yggdrasil was bound. It was an idyllic stretch of Sweden, with a fair blue lake that Freya had turned into a portal when we had to visit Hel. Briett likewise made a portal next to the root of the Midgard tree that was bound to Yggdrasil's, albeit a much smaller one.
"Jump through," she said, "and I'll catch up as you fall. I don't want to set this tree on fire."
So I cannonballed through the portal and fell into shockingly cold air, the sky of Midgard gone and replaced by the gray, dismal mists of Nivelheim. I got about 5 seconds of free fall next to the root of Yggdrasil before I was cocooned in warmth and bright orange flame surrounded my vision. Briett appeared on my right, gesturing that I should straighten out head first like her, and once I did, she redirected our flight, pulling us into a horizontal trajectory 1,000 feet or so above the great Virm Nithog, who was stretched out fatly as he munched at the root of Yggdrasil. We banked west, and Briett pointed out 2 specific rivers originating from the spring of Verglamir.
"That one is the Ver," she said,
indicating the one on the left, which threw up a curtain of steam into the air.
"Which borders Muspelheim. We will follow that, and then turn north at a waterfall,
cross a snowy plain, and find the entrance hidden on a wooded hill. Sentries watch from among the trees.
I nodded, not wanting to shout through fire, and watched the miles disappear underneath us. The lava-scorched crags of Muspelheim were occluded by the steam rising from the Vair River, and I hoped we might see a fire giant from a distance. But all too soon we had banked across the vast sea of snow, never sparkling like it does in sunlight, but gray, slick, and wet, like mucus under the cloud cover. A few islands of stunted pipe-cleaner trees poked up in the distance, the hills Briet spoke of. And off to the east was an anomalous blob of black and light blue that somehow managed to wink and gleam in the dishwater light of Niflheim. I pointed to the blob on the snow and asked Briet, "What's that over there?" Her head swiveled to examine the oddity. And then, when it didn't make any sense to her eyes, she altered our course to take a closer look. A minute or more revealed that we had not been seeing a single thing, but many things, made one by distance. What we were looking at was an army of Aesir, in blue glass armor, the Glass Knights, accompanied by a battalion of stout dwarf elite infantry, the Black Axes. They were marching towards Svartalfheim. The dwarves would have new runes on their axes that could cut a dark elf in smoke form and force him into corporeal solidity. The Glass Knights had defensive runes on their tiled armor that rendered them invulnerable to the Dark Elves' knives, much like my cold iron aura. It allowed them to wait in safety until the Dark Elves could no longer maintain their smoke form, and then shoot them with flechettes as soon as they solidified. Once I explained this to Briet, we pivoted in midair and shot ahead of the army to warn the Dark Elves. The entrance to Svartalfheim boasted no intricately carved stone doors or huge walls, no pillars or obelisks or massive sculptures outside to celebrate and prop up the cultural ego. It was a simple pair of wooden doors set in the hillside, albeit dark like ironwood or ebony, and manned by four bored guards, high enough and wide enough to move in some fabulous furniture, but far short of grandiose. To their credit, the guards did perk up at the approach of a fireball in the sky. They dissolved into black smoke as we touched down, melting snow into a puddle beneath our feet.
"Hold!"
Briet said in Old Norse as soon as she extinguished her flame.
"I am Briet, first among the Fae, and I come in peace to bring you news."
One guard solidified and spoke, though he was nude now. Their clothes had all fallen away when their bodies turned to gases.
"You do not come dressed for peace," he said. "My armor and sword are not for you. They are for the army of Aesir and dwarfs approaching your doors even now."
He cocked his head in disbelief.
"The Aesir have come to Niflheim?" "Yes, and we are here to fight for the Svartalfs. Please alert whoever needs to know, and either allow us entry or bid them come here."
The other three Svartalfs solidified, and the guard who spoke to Briet told one of them to fetch help. He immediately dissolved again and filtered through a gap in the doors without ever opening them for us. The remaining guards didn't speak, knowing that it wasn't really their place to question us. They'd challenged us and sent word to leaders inside, and now it was their task to watch us and wait in silence, like assassins are wont to do, until given further orders. I sloshed out of the puddle of meltwater onto some firmer powder and checked the eastern horizon to see if the army was visible yet. A slightly darker smudge might be them or might not. Niflheim is by and large a bleak smudge of a landscape to begin with. Briet likewise moved out of the puddle so her feet wouldn't freeze in the ice, and eventually a muffled voice called from behind the doors, asking if it was clear. One of the guards responded with something that must have been a code phrase, and the doors opened, allowing the egress of five dark elves dressed in identical shimmering white robes that were tied with sashes of varying colors. They also had circlets on their foreheads, affixed with a stone in the center matching the color of their sashes. I guessed that they represented a guild or governmental structure, though I recalled no one mentioning it before, probably because so few people visited Svartalfheim and lived to tell about it. The woman leading them announced herself to be Turid Einar's daughter. She had a blue stone and sash, and she made introductions without stating titles. One name in particular grabbed my attention. Croker Hrabson.
Croker?
I said. Head of the assassins? He wore a black sash and a piece of polished obsidian in his circlet. He tensed as if he expected me to jump at him, but he answered,
Yes? Who might you be?
I'm the druid that Fand of the Tuatha De Danann hired you to kill. None of your assassins came back, did they? His expression hardened, and he shook his head by way of reply. Well, their deaths weren't entirely my doing. Most of them were taken out by Aesir and a single dwarf runescald. This runescald has figured out how to protect against your black blades and also cut you while you're in your smoke form, making you vulnerable to a killing blow after that. The dark elves scoffed in unison.
Impossible,
Croker said. I witnessed it with my own eyes. He appeared with several axes inscribed with different runes and waded right into the middle of your men. They tried to pierce his armor but could not. Meanwhile, he tested each axe in turn. I believe his fourth one worked. Tore right through smoke, and then a Svartalf took shape with a shallow gash across his chest. He couldn't go back after that, and the dwarf finished him.
And now there's an army in similar armor, Briat said. No doubt with similar weapons, designed to destroy you, and march in here to do just that. Why?
Turid asked.
We've done nothing to them.
It's not what you have done, it's what they fear you will do. They believe you will fight against them when Ragnarok arrives, and they would rather fight you today when they have an advantage than on the day they're beset on all sides.
We have no plans for Ragnarok other than survival,
the dark elf leader protested.
You mean you're neutral?
The Aesir do not see it that way. They are assuming that since you are not actively on their side, you must be on the other side, with Hel and Loki.
That's narrow-minded thinking. This is done with Odin's approval. We do not know for certain since we've not spoken with him,
Briat replied.
But it is difficult to imagine that he is unaware of this. The fact that such a farce marches at all implies his approval.
Where is this force now?
Croker asked. I pointed behind me. See that smudge on the horizon? Croker squinted, then turned to a couple of the guards and asked them to scout the army, admonishing them to stay out of range and not engage.
Assuming that truly is the army you speak of, why are you here to warn us?
Turid asked Briat after the guards had departed.
The Tuatha De Danann have never shown us kindness before. That is true, and I'm not here to be kind now, either,
Briat said.
I'm here because I am sworn to protect Gaia, and she would suffer greatly if the Svartals remain neutral or fight on the side of darkness during Ragnarok.
The Svartals exchanged glances with one another and shrugged, leaving Turid with no advice on how to proceed.
You seem to know more of the future than we do. Why do we matter so much? That I do not know. All I know is that one of our best seers, the Morrigan, said that you must join the side of the Aesir if Gaia is to have a chance of surviving.
Turid's brows drew together, and her mouth drooped in a frown.
What do we care if Midgard falls? I did not speak of Midgard. I spoke of Gaia, the anchor for Yggdrasil, and the Nine Realms, and the anchor for all other planes dreamed up by human minds. If Gaia falls, then so do the Nine Realms, you understand? It is in everyone's interest to ensure Gaia's survival.
Croker scoffed.
So we must join the Aesir, who are even now on their way to kill us all?
Exactly, I said. But this is not insurmountable. It's a misunderstanding. If we can convince them you'll fight with them at Ragnarok, there's no need for bloodshed.
We have no wish to fight with them or against them,
Turid pointed out.
Or to participate in Ragnarok at all.
So lie, I said. And save your people today. Because I've seen their armor in action. The Aesir portion of that army call themselves the Glass Knights. They will systematically fire flechettes once per second and make sure that they hit you when you're corporeal. And their runed tiles are impervious to your weapons. And then the Black Axes will hack you apart like so much meat once you're bound to your naked flesh. That's what happened to your assassins, and it will happen to your entire population if you don't give them a reason to stop.
I don't see how we can change Odin's mind now.
You can worry about changing his mind later. Right now, you need to prevent them from wiping you out. They're incredibly prepared to deny you Sigur Afrekr, victory from smoke. But give them anything else and they'll fall, I said. Use conventional weapons. Bring some archers out here and loose a few flights. Arrows will mow them down.
And fire will burn them,
Briat said, kindling a sphere of flame in the palm of her hand.
Good, Croker said. If you're so anxious to help, we'll let you stall them while we gather a force together behind the gates.
The other dark elves turned their heads and frowned at Croker's words, but did not gainsay him.
We hoped to fight with you rather than for you,
Briat said.
I don't care if you fight. Sing and dance for them if you want. Just give us as much time to prepare as you can.
His peremptory tone struck me as the sort that would get him barbecued. Delivering orders to Briat like that marked him as incredibly confident or simply stupid. Briat did not reply to him, however, or set him on fire for his insolence. Instead, she addressed the other Svartalf leaders.
Does Hrabson speak for all of you in this matter?
They paused, exchanged glances, and then Turid said,
He does. We will prepare and be grateful for any time you can give us.
Unbelievable, I said as they withdrew into the gate, taking the guards with them. Briat's mouth dropped open as the door closed in our faces, leaving us out in the literal cold to face an army by ourselves. The guards who had left earlier to scout the army streamed past us as smoke, not pausing to share their intelligence, but filtering through the cracks of the doors to report their findings.
I think I might know why the Dark Elves have few allies,
she said. Yep, I said, turning around. The smudge on the horizon was a definite chunk of something solid now. Shall we go down to meet them, or wait here?
Let's go down. Quick flight. Are you ready?
I'm still not in great fighting shape, but I'm as ready as I'll be today, I suppose. We may have looked to the Aesir like the descending wrath of Loki as we approached in a ball of fire. That was my guess, judging by their relieved expressions, once we landed in front of them and the dissipating flames revealed our figures. But for my money, they should not have looked relieved at the appearance of Briat. Leading the army, marching in front, was the red-bearded rune-scald Fjallar. He didn't recognize either of us, except as people who were not Loki, since we wore armor. He peered at it rather than at our helmeted faces, trying to discern the nature of the etchings. Briat's bindings looked nothing like runes, however, so all he could learn from them was that we weren't Norse. He called a halt to the march and shifted his axe down from his shoulder to a two-handed grip.
Who are you?
He said. And I was a bit disappointed that he didn't go epic with it and give the moment its proper weight. I'd hoped for a verily or a tell me in sooth. Or something like that. Both of us had full helmets on, so we were merely armed warriors to his eyes. and I realized since Briet had her hair tucked up and didn't forge her armor with the stupid mounds for breasts one sees in video games, he probably didn't realize she was female, much less a goddess. Her head nodded once in my direction, indicating that I should speak for us.
"You know me, Fjallar. I'm Atticus O'Sullivan, Druid of Gaia."
"And who else?"
"Someone more powerful than I am."
He gazed at Briet, who is, in fact, taller than me, and might have guessed her identity if he leapt immediately to the Irish pantheon.
"What are you doing here?"
"We're here to ask you to turn around. I hardly think you have a peaceful mission to the Dark Elves with that army behind you."
"I can't turn around. I have orders from Odin himself."
"But surely you have battlefield command. Call it a strategic withdrawal. The situation's changed and you need to reassess, as does Odin."
"And how has the situation changed?"
"The Dark Elves are under my protection, and the Tuatha De Danann's." Again, Fjallar shifted his eyes to Briet, trying to gauge the threat level she represented. It should be radioactive.
"Why? What makes you care about them?"
"They deserve to live until Ragnarok, like everyone else."
"But they're on the side of Loki and Hel."
"They claim to be on no one's side but their own."
"Of course they say that. But skulking, creeping, they fill all that is not light like the darkness they are."
"Ah, there's the Skald talking now. And it's all poetic bullshit, covering up the fact that you want to walk in and murder people because they might do something at an ill-defined point in the future, and because you don't like the way they look. Go back and rethink this."
"If Odin, in his wisdom, is satisfied that this is the right course, I will not question him."
"Meaning you're not thinking for yourself, and also assuming that Odin has all the facts, when he may not? Have you tried talking to the Svartalfar?"
"It's not my place, nor is it my place to listen to you. There are two sides, Asgard's and theirs. On which side will you stand?"
"First, that's bullshit either-or thinking. And second, I've already told you that the Svartalfar are not on the side of Hel any more than they are on yours. They're neutral, and if you take the time to talk to them instead of marching on them, we could spare a lot of lives here."
"I asked where you stand, Druid."
"Right here in front of you, demanding that you not attempt genocide."
Fjallar paused and craned his neck to look at the gray ceiling of clouds.
"So, you would defy Odin?"
He spied and then pointed to Hugin and Munin circling above us. They had not been there earlier.
"He's watching."
"Then he can watch me say this. I would defy anyone who wished to commit genocide, including Briet. In fact, I was starting to wonder about Odin. Loki wanted to burn the world, and Odin wanted to just wipe out part of it. There was a difference of scale, but the sentiment was the same. Denying people their right to live because you didn't like them. It gave me pause to think about what I was doing. Do vampires have a right to, unlive? Was my situation any different?" "I suppose it was. Theophilus had actively sent Verna Drasha and others to kill my friends and me, and he would doubtless do so again. He intended me to be the last victim of a genocide he'd carried out centuries ago, with the help of the Roman legions, marching to do his bidding, much as Fjallar and company were marching to Odin's. But my rationale of an active self-defense was perilously close to Odin's, and could bear some further scrutiny later."
"I certainly hope you would defy me in such a case," Briet said,
igniting her left fist. It did much to draw Fjallar's attention, as did her three-level voice, in which she could speak only truth and could be quite persuasive.
I am Briat, first among the Fae, and I also will protect the right of the Svartalfar to exist. Withdraw, and let us talk calmly of these matters, and come to an accord.
No,
Fjalar replied.
You underestimate the will of Asgard. The time for talk has passed. We must prepare for Ragnarok.
I cocked my head at him and said, When was the time for talk, exactly? Because I must have missed it. Seems like you haven't talked to the Svartalfar at all.
Enough. You insert yourselves into matters that don't concern you. Move aside.
Be very concerned, Runeskald,
Briat warned in her three-part voice.
If you move forward, you will be the first to die an unnecessary death. I can read those runes well enough to know your armor does not protect against fire.
You may send me to Valhalla if you wish,
Fjallar said.
Either way, I will fight in Ragnarok.
I raised my left hand in a plea for him to stop.
Fjallar, no, wait!
The Runeskald lifted his axe high and shouted,
Æsir!
As soon as he brought it down, pointing it at Briat and shouting,
Forward!
The goddess of fire lit him up like a stump, just as she had promised. And I wondered why people who believed in the next life were so anxious to start living it instead of enjoying the one they had. Fjallar cried out in agony, and the black axes roared in response, charging right through a wall of flame that Briat laid down between us. They went from orderly to berserk in less than a second, and didn't care how hot she could make it for them. They were going to take a swing at us no matter what. Briat unhitched that monstrous sword of hers and swept aside the first few axes. I likewise was able to parry a couple of swings with Frogara, but the tide coming against us was too huge, and the third dwarf who missed kicked me in the right knee, the leg that was already uncertain thanks to Verner Drasha, and I went down. Axes clanged on my cuirass and failed to penetrate, but I still felt them like powerful punches to the ribs. I took a kick to the head, which rung the belfry pretty good. But Frogara's enchantment allowed me to cut off at the knees the dwarf who did it, slicing clean through his armor. Briat helped out by setting those immediately around me on fire. The pain distracted them long enough to delay a coup de grace, and then she bowled through them, hooked her arm underneath one of mine to scoop me up, and turned on the fire jets. We only rose 20 feet or so, and hovered, facing the army, now unable to reach us, their front line on fire and rolling around in the snow to try to extinguish themselves. The black lines of the glass knights fired a volley of flechettes at us, some of which went wide or short. The darts that did hit us pinged harmlessly off our armor.
Not my best diplomatic achievement, I told Briat.
They won't listen while they can choose the path of glorious battle, she replied.
Ugh, yeah.
Maybe we can shut that path down.
I don't wish to set them all on fire. Relations with Odin are going to be strained enough as it is.
I don't want that either. We could immobilize them from here by binding their legs together or whatever. I'll take the leather, you take the glass. Then we talk to Hugin and Munin.
I like this plan.
Then let's make it so, I said, with my best attempt at imitating Sir Patrick Stewart.
We both began to speak in Old Irish, crafting bindings that would force swaths of leather or glass to adhere to another one we targeted nearby. I started with the nearest fully bearded dwarf I could see in the second rank, zeroing in on the leather jerkin peeking through the joints of his armor, and binding it to his neighbor. When they were yanked off balance by the binding and then collided, they fell down into the snow, with much cursing and confusion. I repeated the binding on two more nearby soldiers, and made an ungainly grouping of four hopping-mad dwarfs, spitting at each other as they tried to win free. Then I moved on to repeat the process with four more, and saw that Briat was operating in much the same way, though a lot faster. The glass knights were covered all over in those ruined glass tiles, whereas the leather on the dwarfs was a bit more difficult to pinpoint. It took a half hour or so, but we eventually had the entire army tied up into clusters that could still move if they cooperated, but could certainly not fight. They were having some pretty epic tantrums about it, too. I didn't think the spirit of cooperation was going to blossom anytime soon.
No!
Briet said, projecting her voice over the field as only the goddess of poetry could.
Let us discuss how we can all go home alive after this.
She lowered us to the ground slowly, and it would have been awesome, except that when I touched down, my right leg would not support my weight. Besides the gammy hamstring, my knee had been thrashed, so it was simply saying nope to helping me stay upright. Toppling over sideways did not make me look like a badass. Luckily, Briet was commanding enough for the both of us. Her helmet tilted back, and she found the ravens circling above.
Kjogan and Moonin, Odin, listen well, for I speak true.
Her voice boomed in three registers.
We bear Asgard no ill will, and regret the injuries and death sustained today. We acted to prevent war, and save life rather than take it. We wish the Svartalfar to join us against Loki and Hel on the day that Ragnarok arrives. We believe they will play a pivotal role once they become our allies, instead of a neutral third party. Bringing them to our side will require effort, but it is an effort we feel you should make, so that both they and the Aesir can continue to thrive.
Some jeers and epithets got hurled in our direction at that, but Briet ignored them.
Send an envoy, unarmed, to negotiate in good faith. I will guarantee safe conduct for both sides. Your army will remain here until I hear a reply. They will be released to return to Asgard once that envoy appears. That is all.
Hugin and Moonin squawked and spiraled into the clouds, ascending up the route of Yggdrasil to return to Odin. Briet surveyed the army for potential threats, saw that they remained akimbo in the snow, and supremely cheesed at us, and nodded in satisfaction before turning to check on me.
How fare you, Druid?
Leg is pretty messed up, but I'll be able to limp out of here eventually, working on it.
Is Fjallar truly dead, or can we save him? She took in the charred remains of those she had set aflame. I could smell the cooked flesh and saw smoke rising from the corpses. But I had hoped that perhaps he was merely unconscious. Briet evaluated the bodies for a few seconds and shook her head.
Fire is unforgiving, and I did not hold back.
Oh. I was sorry for that, and wished Fjallar would have been more reasonable. Silence fell between us, except for the uncomfortable shifting of bodies in the army, and the dark curses muttered at us from various quarters.
Shall we go visit the Svartalfs while we wait?
I said. Sitting here in front of the army is getting awkward fast.
Very well.
We flew back to the dark doors of Svartalfame and called out that we had good news. The army had been halted, and an envoy would arrive soon for talks.
No one else need die today, Briet said. We can talk in peace of a more lasting accord.
With her permission, I stood behind her right shoulder, kept my weight on my left leg, and surreptitiously leaned on her back for support. Soon the doors opened, and the leaders of the Svartalfar reemerged. This time, they deigned to favor Briet with a shallow bow, and she in turn did the same and removed her helmet. If I stopped leaning on Briet to remove mine, I would fall over, so I kept my helmet on. It was poetry after that. Briet was much better at slinging words around than I was, and before long we had a pavilion set up outside with tables and chairs and hot drinks and nobody killing anybody else. I got to sit. Briet melted some snow away so that I could put my bare foot down on the earth and draw some strained energy from Gaia to aid my healing. And then she employed that honey-throated voice of hers to convince Turid and Croker that fighting against the hordes of hell would be better for the Svartalfar in the long run than sitting it out. The logic being that it was quite possibly going to be the end of the world, and you didn't want that one to go the wrong way. She actually made them smile and laugh a couple of times. Until the envoy from Asgard showed up an hour later. It was not who we expected. Not that we expected anyone in particular, just